Here's a little trailer, just a summary. This is kind of like something you'd read on the back of a book if this is the book of John. So in John chapter 9, we'll be looking through that this morning. You can turn there if you'd like. It's this. It's an inspiring story of a man born blind, and we see Jesus work a miracle. A man who was forced to beg just to survive with his hand outstretched to strangers, and now he has his life forever changed when Jesus rubs mud on the man's eyes. When the mud is washed away from the eyes, the man is ecstatic as he can see. But the townspeople and the religious leaders question the validity of the miracle. In a stunning twist of events, the man is left to defend an obvious miracle and to vouch for his miracle worker. A revealing tale of injustice, interrogation, and power that brings to light the spiritual blindness of a darkened world. That's what we're going to look at today. So, John chapter 9 is Jesus and his disciples are walking along, and they see a man who is born blind, and they make sure that they tell you this, that he was a man born blind. So this has been a condition he's always had. And the disciples say to Jesus, "Teacher, Rabbi, why was this man born blind? Was it because of his sin, or was it those of his parents? Who was the cause of this?" And so then Jesus says, well, they start to find out this reason. Why has this man been born blind? Who sinned? Who could have caused this? This is always the way that we've been, right? We've always needed a way to explain the condition of someone's situation. If we could bring a framework to this, then we can kind of figure it out. It can make sense to us. And so this has been happening in all kinds of different places, different cultures, different religious systems. I think of the caste system that would say, well, it was the sins of you know, past lives that has caused this, and so therefore this person has this affliction, this problem, this disability because of a past life. It must have been something that's happened in the past, which calms everyone, you know, that sees this, because you can see incredible injustice in the world that is somehow reconciled, because you go, well, like this person, you know, they're begging on the street while I have incredible wealth and power, and this other person is there begging. The reason is that they have done something in their past. Now, if I was to help that person, I would actually be causing them an extended recovery from their situation, because if I try to alleviate their suffering, that's somehow purifying them and making them, you know, pay for this this thing that's happened in their past. Well then, you know, I don't want to mess this up. I don't want to get in the way of that, so I'll just step over them and carry on, you know, in my life. That's kind of the caste system problem that was there. It was like a ranking that was there, but the way the injustices in the world were kind of like resolved, because it was like, well, they brought that on themselves in the past life, right? So who sinned? Well, it must have been someone, must have been them in the past. Another thought is like karma, right? That we do bad things in the past, and somehow that results in this situation that we have. And so when Jesus' disciples ask him, they say, why was this man born blind? Was it because of his own sins or that of his parents? Well, it was also true in Jewish thought that they would say someone's disability must have been the result of someone's sin. So if you were born blind, you either had to sin in the womb, which doesn't really make sense, so it must have been that your mother would have sinned, and so she's brought this on you. Can you imagine the guilt that would last, that would be on the mother in this situation? She would have to do all this soul-searching and wonder, how had she caused this for her child? And so this brings up a couple myths that we have with suffering. The first myth is this, that personal suffering is due to sin. The only question is, then, once you decide, well, this must have been sin, now we just have to figure out is whose sin was it, and we can point the finger. But it's a simplistic attempt to make sense of the world, right? And the thing was that Jesus said it wasn't because of his sins or his parents' sins that this happened in verse 3. This happened so the power of God could be seen in him. Which brings us to myth number 2, which is this, that God always uses suffering to display his power. I've heard people who are going through a really difficult situation, whether it be cancer or maybe a, you know, some kind of a breakup that's, you know, brokenness that's in their family, whatever it might be, And I've heard people say, God's going to use this to display his glory. God's going to do amazing things through this, and you'll be able to share this with so many people that God has done this. The problem with that is that it heaps so much pressure on the person. And so then they think that God's bringing this suffering, and it's just too heavy a burden to place on the person who is suffering, to say that God's going to use this to impact many people. For some, this brings strength and encouragement, right? It brings a sense of purpose to their situation. They go, God can do this. Yes, he can do it. But does he always do that? Well, for others, it just comes across like God is abusing them for his own personal gain, right? Can someone else please have this privilege is kind of the thought. You know, can God show his glory through someone else, please? Because this is too painful for me. So there's a dimension of suffering that defies all explanation. One thing that is consistent, though, is that God cares for those who are suffering. And so that's why Jesus says, this happens so the power of God can be seen in him. God chose to use this situation. He doesn't always do this, but in this situation, God was going to reveal his power in this man's life. And so Jesus says, we must quickly carry out the tasks assigned us by the one who sent us. The night is coming, and then no one can work. But while I'm here in the world, I am the light of the world. We prayed that this morning already, that Jesus is the light of the world. So Jesus was aware of the shortness of time, that things were moving on quickly, and that there's only a certain, you know, there's a sense of urgency that he had about his actions. So Jesus, what he does is he calls us to action, is kind of what I get from this. He calls us to action, not debate. Let's not just go over, well, whose fault is this, and what can we do? And do you think that, you know, we get caught up in a lot of theologizing and speculating? Meanwhile, there's a person suffering beside the side of the road. This beggar who was born blind is sitting there, stuck in his situation, and they want to just talk about it. And Jesus says, no. You know, there's despair is coming in. It's this darkness, and yet he's the light of the world. He wants to make a difference and to change things. So Jesus calls for action. And so as the light of the world, he brings, his very presence brings hope. So what did Jesus do? It's kind of a bit of a gross story in a way. I don't know why Jesus chose to do it this way, but he went and decided to spit in the ground, and he turns this spit and this dirt into mud. And then he goes and he anoints the man's eyes, it says. He rubs it on his eyes, and he sends this blind man off with, you know, spit and dirt in his eyes, and says, go off to the pool of Siloam, which means sent. He says, go off to the pool and wash yourself. So, interesting thing here. Has the man seen Jesus yet? He's blind, right? And then Jesus makes sure he can't see him, puts mud on his eyes, and sends him away, and he goes off to the pool of Siloam. And so I thought it was interesting as I was reading about this that, you know, Jesus involves him in the solution. It's an interesting thing to kind of mull around is that Jesus gives him a task that he must now do in obedience. Did the pool of Siloam, did it heal him? No, it was Jesus who healed him, but he sent him off. And so the question is, would he have been healed had he not gone to the pool of Siloam? Probably not. He wouldn't have followed through with that obedience, right? So it's an interesting little side story there, and yet a big part of this miracle that happens. And so the man goes off to the pool, washes his eyes clean, and he can see. I can't imagine this. For the first time in your whole life, he was born blind, never had seen anything. And I wonder what it's like to open your eyes for the first time and to look around and all those things you've imagined, what they might look like, and then to see them how they really are. Must have been just this incredible thing. He would have been overjoyed and ecstatic. So the change was so immediate and so dramatic for this man that he could see. The people actually didn't even recognize him. They say, wasn't that the guy that we used to walk by him on the way back from the temple all the time? Wasn't that the man? And wasn't he always begging and stuff? It, it kind of looks like him, it sounds like him, but it was, they just weren't sure. And so they come up to him, and he's like, it's me, it's really me, I am that guy. And they said, well, tell us what happened. And he said, well, Jesus, he went and he mixed some mud and stuck it on my eyes, and then, you know, like he anointed my eyes, and then I went and washed off, and I was clean, and I could actually see, and I have this miracle. And all of a sudden, they're like, just a second, did you say that Jesus mixed mud and spit together? Did you say that he kneaded that together and he made this mud? Did he anoint your eyes? And he's like, yeah, that, like, this is, look at what happened. And the man then got himself into a corner, because what he had just done was revealed that Jesus had done all kinds of wrong things. Because it turns out, they tell us in John 9 here, that it just so happened that it was the Sabbath. Jesus seemed to always pick the Sabbath, at least the stories in the Bible seemed to always point to the Sabbath as being the day when he would do these things that would get him into trouble. So it turns out that he had 3 infractions on the Sabbath that Jesus just had done. And so these people were going to catch Jesus in the act of sinning. And so they took this man off to, they took him to the Pharisees, and he started to work through all the infractions that Jesus had just incurred. The first was that he healed on the Sabbath. Now, Pharisaical law said that you could save someone's life on the Sabbath, but you couldn't perform a miracle if it wasn't life-threatening on the Sabbath. And so they would just leave that person till Sunday, right? And till the next day. But the other was that he made mud. And the translation actually talks about him kneading the spit and the dirt together, and somehow that made the mud. So it was like kneading bread, which was also a no-no. You couldn't make bread on the Sabbath. And so that was work. And then the third infraction was kind of an iffy one. There was debate within the you know, even among the Pharisees, whether this was actually a thing, but they said because he anointed his eyes, that anointing someone on the Sabbath was also considered to be an infraction. And so Jesus had stirred up all kinds of controversy. And so the Pharisees brought this healed man into their midst there, and they start inquiring of him, and they're asking him all these questions. So what did he do? Tell us again. So he spit in the dirt, and so he has to defend himself, and he has to defend Jesus. And he said, this just didn't, you know, the problem was it just didn't add up in the Pharisees' minds, because Jesus had broken the Sabbath laws, so he clearly was a sinner, and yet this man had clearly been healed, so God had done work. How could God work through a sinner like Jesus if... You know, and they're trying to figure this all out. So they start debating around this man. And I was imagining, you know, they're probably in the synagogue kind of an area, and they're questioning him, and this man who is just seeing things for the first time in his life is looking around amazed, right, at everything around him. And yet there's this huge debate happening around going, I don't know, I think Jesus must be a sinner. There's no way that he could come from God. And the man's like, look at my eyes, I can see you, like I'm standing right here. And they go around and around, and finally they say, is this really the man? Let's get his parents in and hear their side. So they bring the parents in, and they say, is this your son? And they go, he's the one. And then they say, did he really, like, did who was it that healed him? Well, right then, the parents, they back off, right? Because they say, you're not going to drag us into this mess. Because if we say that Jesus healed him and that Jesus was sent by God, we're going to get ourselves kicked out of the synagogue. They're actually going to boot us out of here, which means, think about this in a community like this, the synagogue was the center for all kinds of things. It was a center where you would meet with God, right? You would have your spiritual connection would happen in this environment. They would also be your connections with the community. So if you were going to have work, if you're going to network, and if you had your livelihood, it could be in jeopardy based on your being excommunicated from this, this group of people. And then the other is that it was their community, it was their friends, it was where they wanted to go for friends and family. And they knew that that was going to be kind of a problem if they agreed with their son's testimony and said that Jesus was the one that healed him. And so they quickly said, no, you talk to him, he's old enough, he can defend himself and he can explain it. This poor guy was begging, right? So for his livelihood, he had to beg. So clearly, his parents didn't have a lot of means, or they were incredibly cruel to him and just sent him out to do this. So he was basically left on his own to defend himself and to defend Jesus. And so then they go into the third phase of this interrogation, this interview, and they come back, and they keep pressing him. Where do you think he came from? Was he from God? And all of this. And so they get mad at him, and they actually curse him at one point, which is a great thing for religious leaders to do. They cursed him, and they said, should God get the glory for this? Because we know this man, Jesus, is a sinner. In other words, don't let Jesus get the credit for being, you know, for this miracle. It clearly was, it couldn't be him. So religious people, leaders in this context, have this way of deciding who's in and who's out, who fits and who doesn't. But the problem was that their theories, their theology theories, kind of came face to face with a man's experience, a very profound experience he was able to see, and he was standing right in front of them. So this man, he cuts right through the debate, the questions, and he basically says this, I don't know whether he's a sinner, but I know this. I was blind, but now I can see. It's a profound statement, right? You can go on with all your, you know, theology mumbo-jumbo, but I just know I can see. So deal with that, right? It's that kind of thing. And then they say, well, we know that God spoke to Moses, but we don't even know where this man comes from. They were kind of comparing it to that, right? And then this guy, he gets a little feisty, right? And he says, that's strange. He healed my eyes, and yet you don't know where he comes from? This man performs miracles, and you can't figure it out? Well, they got angry, kick him out. And the Pharisees, they just didn't know what to do with Jesus. They could not open themselves to the possibility that this could be the Messiah, that he could be the one that was sent by God. And their faith was built in such a fragile way. It was like, it's compared to a house of cards, I guess, that it could tumble at any time. Like if you just mess with the system here, it doesn't fit for them. So the bottom line for them was Jesus. He's the cornerstone. Everything was to be built around Jesus. But as we read in 1 Peter 2, the stone that the builders rejected has now become the cornerstone. He is the stone that makes people stumble, the rock that makes them fall. So these men who claim to have spiritual sight and vision and experience, they tripped over Jesus, the cornerstone. The Pharisees could not recognize that Jesus was the chosen one of God, the Messiah. They could just not wrap their heads around the fact that he was, that this is around the thought of a Messiah who was able to interpret the law in a different form. That Jesus would perform and do these things on the Sabbath just did not fit their preconceived ideas of what the Sabbath was for, and they assumed that he would fulfill everything like Moses did, that he would be a zealot for the law, and that he would fulfill all of these finer points. But they forgot Isaiah 35:5. When the Messiah comes, he will open the eyes of the blind and unplug the ears of the deaf. The Pharisees just couldn't see Jesus as the Messiah. Now contrast that with the man who was healed. After the inquiry, Jesus came and found the man and he talked to him. And he said, you know, I'm the one that healed you. And then immediately the man says, yes, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him in verse 38. There's different kinds of blindness. My son Zach, when he was a preschooler, had to get some dental work done. And so we had to sedate him because we weren't sure how this was going to go. So we gave him a little sedation that the dentist gave us and said, just try this. And they ended up, you know, we weren't sure. We'd never tried this before. And so we gave him a little bit of this sedative, whatever it was. And all of a sudden, from the other room, we hear Zach call out. He's like, "I can't see." I'm like, "Oh, there's some kind of an allergic reaction happening." We run into the room, not realizing that Zach was standing there with his eyes closed. And he's like teetering because he's going to fall asleep, right? "I just can't open them." Well, there's that kind of blindness that was easily remedied. But there's a blindness that can come from a variety of things. We can be blinded genetically. We can be born blind. But there are other forms that we often run into. And we use this in our language. We can be blinded by hatred, right? Or we can get in a blind rage. Think about some of the people with road rage that's out there. They have this blind rage that just everything goes, well, actually, in the case of domestic violence people, it can actually go red. They can see red, and that's all they see. And so there's this idea of just this intense anger that blinds us. We can be blinded by fear, and we don't see those around us in the way that we should. And this type of blindness can make it impossible to see how God is at work around us. So Jesus says loud enough, you know, he's talking to the man who is healed now, but he says it loud enough that the Pharisees can hear him saying this. And he says, "I entered this world to render judgment, to give sight to the blind, and to show those who think they see that they're blind." Some Pharisees that were around said, "Are you saying that we're blind?" And then Jesus comes back with this. If you were blind, like physically blind, you would, and if there's a reason that there are blinders in your life, you wouldn't be guilty. But you remain guilty because you claim that you can see. Their spiritual pride had made them blind to the work of Jesus. They couldn't acknowledge that for could not acknowledge him for who he was. And their resistance to Jesus made it impossible for them to experience God's work of grace in their lives. Or to celebrate, remember, this is all around a miracle, that they couldn't even celebrate with a man who was born blind. They ended up being so consumed by the nitpickiness of their rules and regulations that they completely missed the point of this whole story, that the man who was born blind was now able to see. That's incredible. Revelation 3:17, Jesus says, "You say I'm rich. I have everything I want. I don't need a thing." But you don't realize that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. That's to people who are content in their own situation and go, "Ah, God's good. I go to church, do my things, everything's fine." But we don't realize that he has to be Lord of our life, that he needs to take over every area of our life. In Matthew 6:23, Jesus said, "When your eye is bad, your whole body is filled with darkness. And if the light you think you have is actually darkness, how deep that darkness is." So when we think that we are in okay standing with God, and yet there's this lordship issue that we really have not surrendered our lives to God in every area, how deep that darkness is. We're deceiving ourselves. We think that we're something that we're not. During this Lenten season, we need to take time to reflect. So have we made assumptions about who Jesus is and how he works? That he's, you know, like, do we have these preconceived ideas about him? Have we decided that God can only act in certain ways? Have we said, "Well, there's no way that God would do that in someone's life"? Is our spiritual vision blurry? And are we experiencing spiritual vision problems? That's really what this idea of reflecting and wondering and questioning where we're at. That's what Jesus needs to do in our lives. And we say, "Jesus, are you truly Lord of my life? Are you my Savior? Have I put all of my weight onto you? Am I trusting you in my life? Jesus, are there areas in my life that I need to surrender, that I'm just hanging on to and I'm not surrendering them to you? Let's take some time to reflect. Jesus, would you stir in our hearts? Would you point to things in our lives that are a barrier from seeing you for who you really are? Would you take those blinders off of our eyes, that we'd be able to see you in all your glory, and that you would do a work, a miracle in our lives, as you have in so many in this room? I know that you have worked miracles in our lives, not just physical, but spiritual miracles. Thank you that you've touched us, that you've reached out to us. I pray that the eyes of your heart will be flooded with light so that you can understand the confident hope he has given to those he called his holy people, who are his rich and glorious inheritance. Amen.